a day or two ago. In fact, maybe 3 days ago, because we took an intermission to speak about Teruah. At least I was called on account of saying that reading an interlinear, and I was told that an interlinear is not a translation. It beg to differ. An interlinear is absolutely a translation. Translates. In this case, we're translating Greek to English, and I read a statement. I'm going to reread the statement, then I'm going to talk to you a moment about word order, then we're going to read the statement as exactly as it was written by Paul, and we do still have Larry Worth with us. The statement as it is presented in the Nestle Allend McReynolds interlinear, and the reason we're using that is the Nestle Allend is the most universally accepted Greek manuscript, and their internal interlinear for it, McReynolds, would be considered the most authorized, if you will. It says, or certainly the most scholastic. Now for men, I persuade, or the God. Or I seek men to please. Still, if still men, I was pleasing of Christ, slave not, I was. Now, Larry, before I read this, and as it in a more amplified and accurate translation based upon the Papyrus 46, the oldest witness to this text, do you think that changing the word order, now for men I persuade or the God, or I seek men to please, if still men, I was pleasing of Christ, slave not, I was, is going to make that gibberish sensible?
No. It's gibberish, and he was a poor writer. How anybody could confuse the verbal diarrhea that spewed out of the mouth of this clown, Paul,
yes,
with Scripture is beyond me. It's beyond me.
Yeah, it's beyond me, too. Now, let me read it to you in a word-for-word translation from the oldest manuscript. It begins for, or and it's gar, and gar can be for or because. Currently, this is arti, simultaneously, just now. Men from anthropos. I persuade. Pietho. I presently, actively, and actually use words to win the favor of. I seduce, mislead, coax, convince, appease, and placate. Or, this is from E, alternatively, the God. The God is from a placeholder, in this particular case, it's pretty evident that the placeholder was added by whoever copied the original letter, trying to make the original letter consistent with the eyewitness accounts. Or, E, by comparison or contrast, I seek, zeto, I attempt and desire to please, aresco, to accommodate men, anthropos, humans. Yet, nevertheless, eti, in addition, besides, if, from ei, men, anthropos, I was pleasing and accommodating, aresco, I was exciting the emotions of and lifting up, slave, Dulios, of Christu. A placeholder was used in the oldest manuscript. Certainly, not was me. An oi imi. Certainly, not was me. Okay. I think we know what he was trying to say. But if this is supposed to be Scripture inspired word for word by God, should it be our responsibility to fix his sentences, to fix his grammar, to reorder the words, to make sense of this? Is it our responsibility to make Paul sound sensible, articulate, when he wasn't?
Clearly. No. He wrote like a boob. It should be presented as it was written.
Why
should we copy edit anything? Why don't we just show people the raw truth?
Right.
I mean, that's just the truth.
Right. What he's trying to do here is saying, okay, there's two different messages being promoted, two different messages, and that he was the advocate for one of the two, and others who were unnamed were the advocate of the other. Now, he will name them later. They were Yaakonin, they were Shimon Kefesh, and they were Jacob, the three leaders amongst Yahusha's disciples are his enemies. So he will tell us who his foes are later. But at this point, they're unnamed. And he's saying that they conveyed a message that was contrary to his, and that therefore they are cursed. And so now he's trying to say, okay, for his message, was his message trying to persuade God or trying to seek the favor of men?
He was trying to seek the favor of men.
Yeah,
you know?
Clearly. Now, the initial verb, pietho, was written in the first person singular, present active, indicative, which not only means that Paul is again operating on his own, but that the opening sentence literally reads, because currently men, I presently, actively, and actually use words to win favor of, pietho, or the God. So regardless of which option we choose, this question poses a series of rather serious problems. First, the transition from we as the sources of the lone acceptable message in the previous statement, and as the originators of the curse, to I in this question, where men and God represent the universe of potential answers. That's quite curious. Why did he switch from we to I, particularly in the context of men and God? Rather than partnering with men, as we might imply, Paul is opposing men in some sort of grand debate. Is that what we're supposed to read from this? Or rather than partnering with God, as we might also suggest, is Paul actually arguing against him? I mean, those are your options. Which one of those do you prefer? And while Paul's personal confessions, as one of his confessions, his positions and his approach affirm throughout that his partner is Satan. You know, there is a hint of delusional arrogance here as this transitions back to I, because no matter how we translate pietho, Paul is implying that his rhetoric and reason are sublime. It's as if he wants us to believe that he is so much smarter than everyone else, he could take on God and men single-handed.
You know, one of the things I find odd, and I really find this odd, he claims that Satan came and put a thorn in his side to humble him so he could get out God's message better. So somehow, or that's the way I read it, so somehow...
No, he actually said it slightly differently. The way he said it is much worse than what you've just surmised.
Yeah, he said he was demon-possessed.
Right, that's what he said. Because what he said is that he said that the thorn in his side, and the thorn is a goad and a scorpion stinger, is the other two ways that the word for thorn can be described as a goad, and he references the goad when he speaks of his encounter with Satan on the road to Damascus. Difficult to rebel against the goad. The goad controls animals. So it's really a goad in his side, but it's also the word for scorpion stinger, because Yosha would use the same concept to describe the way that Satan manipulates people in our world. But what Paul actually wrote is that stinger, that thorn, that goad in his side was a messenger of Satan, therefore a demon.
Yeah, but he was helping Yahweh get out the word by humbling Paul. So Satan was working against Satan. It was it's incredible to me. It's just incredible.
Yeah, that Paul would say that where he never says that he was imbued with the spirit of the set apart spirit, or the spirit of Yahweh, or the spirit of Yahusha, he does say that he was possessed and controlled by the spirit of Satan. But he tells us, it's all for good. It's all for good. You're going to keep my ego in check.
Yeah, it's good that Satan controls me. This keeps my ego in check so I can get you the truth out.
Yeah.
It's the most bizarre.
I'm going to tell you, I have something that controls my ego. And that is my propensity to be errant. My propensity to continue to be flawed. I have, when I'm confronted with Yahweh's brilliance, my ego is in check. It's not hard. It's really easy to understand my relative lack of intelligence compared to Yahweh and the brilliance of his testimony. So I've got a wonderful check for my ego. I most certainly wouldn't want a demon to be controlling me to tamp down my personal ego. I can't even imagine why somebody would admit to that. I can't imagine. You know why Paul admitted to being demon-possessed in the middle of his second letter to the Corinthians?
You tell me why this bizarre... Tell me. I mean, I really have a hard time reading his tripe. I really do.
Okay.
You know.
The reason that Paul admitted to being demon-possessed is he was so egotistical, as is Satan, the one who possessed him, that they wanted to poke a finger in God's face and say, yeah, these humans that you were so devoted to, that you sacrifice so much for, that you care so much about, these stupid humans, we're going to show you just how utterly moronic and worthless they are. I'm going to have my number one spokesman and my number two spokesman, Paul first, Muhammad later, both admit that they're demon-possessed, that I'm controlling them. I'm going to have them admit it in the middle of their religious text. And your creation is so stupid, they'll believe that you inspired it. How about that for stupid? That's the reason. They realize that people are easy to fool, particularly with religion. And that God's creation will squander their souls without a moment's thought. And that's what we do this show to prevent. And we'll be back. You know, in this sentence, Paul said, for currently men I persuade. And, you know, persuade is the God, the best we can possibly do in terms of slanting this in favor of Paul. Is him winning the favor and persuading and convincing either men or God. But every other connotation of this verb is substantially worse, because it would read, I presently, actively, and actually seduce, mislead, coax, appease, and placate men or God. So if you actually translate the full meaning of the word to I seduce, mislead, coax, appease, and placate. Even if it's persuade, men or God, the answer, there is no good answer. I mean, if he didn't ask a question, but should he have asked the question? Am I placating God? Am I misleading God? Am I misleading men? Am I appeasing God? Or am I appeasing men? Larry, can you help me out here? Which one of those choices would be good?
Might be too many dangling participles out there. I have no idea what the guy's saying.
Let's take the dangling participles away. Let's say that I am coaxing and misleading God.
Would that be good? This is bad news.
I am seducing and placating men. Would that be good?
This would be bad news.
So what I'm saying is, even if we fix his grammar, the options are, no, that would be really bad. No, the question that you're asking, whether you are seducing, misleading, coaxing, or appeasing, or placating men.
Whether it be God or man, you're in bad shape.
Correct.
I've never seen, and this is the truth. Yes. I look at the prophets. Prophets are people who either write or speak on behalf of Yahweh.
Yes,
and I'll tell you what we know about them. Just about nothing, because they don't
correct.
Talk about themselves.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, there's just enough information to put the prophet in the context of history so that we know when the environment and the audience with whom and the timeline with whom the prophet was speaking. And occasionally, Yahweh will say, you know, the reason I'm working through people is I want the human aspect to come through. And so he'll occasionally go to someone like Hosea and says, hey, I want you to go marry a temple prostitute over there. I want you to marry Gomer. And, you know, and Hosea says, hey, you want me to do what? And he says, yeah, I do. I want you to go marry the temple prostitute over there. And he'll say, you're kidding, right? He says, no, I want you to be able to speak to the children of Israel with the same emotion, with the same passion that I'm trying to speak to them, because from my perspective, they went off and married a prostitute. And so if you have to deal in a marriage with a prostitute, a temple, a religious whore, then you're going to not just be able to say my words. They're going to come out of your mouth with great conviction and feeling because you're enduring the same thing that I'm having to endure with them. So occasionally, you know, we get a little glimpse into their lives.
And it's pretty slight. It's pretty slight.
Right. It is.
For
it
the
is.
Most part, you take Zachariah, he says, you know, it's the eighth month of the second year of King Darius of Persia when Yahweh came to me with these words, here I go, and boom! You know, that's the end of Zachariah, this great prophetic, incredible prophet. And, and yet, we know nothing of him, but we know all about Paul because he was the rabbi among rabbis. He was smarter than the smartest man that ever lived. He was an incredible
in his own mind
from far steeper
mind.
Slopes. Oh,
right.
Absolutely.
In his own mind.
To the point Satan had to go help himself against Satan in order to curtail Paul, because Paul may have been greater than Satan, maybe. I don't know why.
You know, that's my view is that Paul got so full of himself that the reason that he was demon-possessed was to control Paul's ambition, because Satan wants to be God. And Paul positions himself as the Savior, as the messenger, as the totality of everything that's important. And so Satan and Paul got in conflict with one another, and that was Satan's means of ratcheting him down so that that Paul would promote Satan as God as opposed to promoting Paul as God.
Can I bring something up here? I mean, this needs to be said, I believe. There are people probably listening to this that are thinking, Larry and Yada are all screwed up here. They don't know what's going on because my Aramaic Bashura has Paul's letters in there. Well, the oldest we have are the 69, actually, Parchment 46, or Papyrus 46 that we're talking about today. They're older than the Aramaic.
Into the last segment, both positions you were attempting to make, Larry, were accurate. The Aramaic translations of what Paul wrote don't resolve what Paul wrote. It's obvious that Paul wrote in Greek. He was speaking to an audience that was literate in Greek and in Latin. And he wrote in Greek. We have a copy of his letters, of really all of his letters, Parchment 46, that dates to the late 1st, early 2nd century. This manuscript that I am sharing as part of this program was translated from that codex. It's a codex of Paul's letters written on papyrus. As I say, it dates to around 85 to 110, 115 CE. So it's the closest papyrus that we have to the actual author's letter of anything that is purported to be part of the so-called Christian New Testament. Now, there are 69 codexes that exist of the so-called Christian New Testament that were written before Constantine rose to power, the pagan general, the Roman general, a vicious man, Constantine. Now, Constantine's rise to power changed everything in terms of the manuscripts, and that's why we only refer to those prior to Constantine, because after Constantine, there's almost no pretext of textual fidelity. At that point, everything is a free-for-all, and the manuscripts that comprise the Christian New Testament were so heavily edited to achieve a religious agenda that they aren't even remotely reliable. And so we do have 69 pre-Constantine, pre-325 codexes. Among the oldest, among them is parchment 46, which contains Paul's letters. The Aramaic document, the oldest Aramaic translation of Paul's letters, dates to the 6th century. And so to infer that it is an original, that it predates these manuscripts that we have from the 1st and 2nd century, is as big a religious leap of faith as it is to believe that Paul spoke for God. You have to completely...
It's not just that. You know, I don't even believe they go back to the 6th century, what they put in these Aramaic books, because you see the same copy edits that are in the Textus Receptus. So I think what they're doing is copying off the 1515 Textus Receptus.
Yeah. For example, if you were to find the 8th chapter of Jaokanaan, where there's the encounter with the adulterous woman, where the Christian Jesus writes something in the sand. Sin, cast the first stone. And, of course, the whole thing is completely made up. The story actually exists is the 8th century. It's a great test to see whether or not it was a translation from even a later document would be the inclusion of that.
It is in there, by the way, in the Aramaic Bashura.
Great.
The story of the stone drawing is in there.
Yes. All right, so it doesn't date to the 6th century. It has to date to a time after the 9th century. And there's a number of sites now that are claiming that they have the original autographs of the Christian New Testament, and that they're in Aramaic, and that they were found here, there, and every place. It's an absolute pile of lies. And
One of them is a missionary. A missionary.
So
Yahweh engaged a cleric,
right,
to go find a guy that makes his living whoring words.
Right.
You know, that's right. Who he engaged
to find
the oldest.
And, of course, the documents always include Paul's letters, and Paul was overtly anti-Yahweh, anti-disciples.
Interestingly enough, they include the exact same canon.
Mm-hmm, of course.
You know, that a bunch of politically inspired guys used.
Yeah.
So,
the canon that was actually put together of the Christian New Testament was created in around 325, it was not actually the Council of Nicaea that did that. The Council of Nicaea was actually to remove Arius from consideration. It was called Arian philosophy, which was that Yahusha was begotten, and therefore he was a diminished manifestation of Yahweh and was not the totality of God. That didn't work in the new religion, so even though it
they
was
had
true,
to separate him.
Right,
totally.
he had to be labeled a heretic. That was the purpose of the Nicene, which was the Greek God of Victory Council.
And that leads me to this day that I'm doing Teruah, where I have a posting in a group that I was put into, and I'm reading it, and it says... And this is from a guy, he wrote it, I didn't. So if I'm to understand this correctly, and he puts YHVH/YHWH, is the Lord, who is not the one Elohim like Yahushua, parentheses Jesus, but the dragon. When Yahushua comes back, he will defeat the Lord and the dragon.
Huh.
Wow! He's going full retard! I mean, I'm sitting here looking at this, and I am amazed that anybody could glean that.
Right.
It's astonishing that the diminished manifestation of Yahweh himself would then turn around and fight Yahweh. I asked him. I showed him where Eliyah is going to put back. I said, you probably call him Elijah. Is going to be one of these two prophets in Revelation. I said, now, so this is Yahweh providing a prophet speaking in Revelation in order to defeat himself, if I am to get this correct. Right. You know, I am
By the
amazed.
Way, I don't even know where people get this idea, and it's was the basis of Seventh-day Adventism Christianity. That and it's the basis also of Kabbalah, which is Rabbinic Judaism, that there's going to be this war between a representative of Yahweh, and they make it the Messiah, and Satan. You know, they're not going to fight a war.
No.
Their relative power, their relative influence is such that they're not going to fight a war. Yahweh is going to imprison Hasatan, and he's going to imprison all of those in league with Hasatan. He's not going to go fight them in a war. This is not going to be a mighty battle. There's no spiritual forces in conflict here. He's going to incarcerate them. End of story. This whole cosmic war that people think is going to occur is ludicrous.
Yeah. It's like they don't believe Yahweh really is in control of what he wants to control.
Yeah. How can you fight something that that created you? You
correct.
Can't.
Yeah.
This
like
isn't
the pot saying I'm going to go to war against the one that molded me.
This isn't Greek mythology.
Right.
You're not. This is
right.
He's going to try, and it's not like when he was created that. Yahweh didn't know that this is what he was going to do. He was created for a specific purpose.
But in the first revelation that Yahweh gives to man, he tells us about Hasatan's fate. And Hasatan plays an extraordinarily important role in the development of this story. Without him, there really is no credible choice. I mean, without him creating religions and nationalized political schemes, without him speaking through the abominators of this world, possessing Paul and Muhammad, then it would be very difficult to dissuade the majority of people from participating in the covenant. And so Hasatan was allowed to slither into the garden to corrupt Yahweh's testimony, to provide a believable alternative to what God was offering, so that you really do have to study the text, determine what God said, who is speaking for him and who is not. That's the reason we're going through these Pauline letters, to prove to people that he did not speak for God, so that you can make a quality decision. But after the last decision is made, during the midst of the tribulation, and people take sides, either the beast or Yahweh, and you're marked accordingly. You know, at that point, the choice is over, and Hasatan is locked up for 1,000 years. That's what happens to him. You know, it's any other reading is imagination. Now, returning to Paul's letters here, the third point I'd like to make is that in spite of what religious zealots have been led to believe, we are not called to win the favor of men, and we most certainly can't win the favor of God. We're not called even to persuade or convince men. Yahweh's words will persuade and convince the open-minded, but it's not our job to do that. It's the job of his testimony. All we can do is share his testimony. And the notion of persuading and convincing God of anything is nonsensical. We can reason with God, we can have discussions with God, we can learn from God, but we aren't going to persuade God. We're not going to convince God that we're right and that he's wrong. It's just not going to happen. It's God's job to convince, not ours. And even then, Yahweh isn't interested in winning our favor. He isn't interested in persuading us. He lays out the opportunity to form a relationship with him. He proves that we can trust him through prophecy. He invites us to get to know him. But that's as far as God goes. Therefore, even if we render pietho as favorably as possible, the answer to the question is men. God's approach, Paul's approach, is ungodly. So if he's trying to present to persuade men, he's taking an approach that is inconsistent with Yahweh. And if the answer is God, then Paul's arrogance is in league with Satan. In this, there is no way to solve this. It's not just a matter of grammar. It's not just that Paul can't write. Now, that's the good news. When any of Pietho's alternative definitions are considered, Paul becomes the Lord of Deceit. The devil's pietho, he seduces, misleads, coaxes, appeases, and placates. That's why he's known as the Prince of Lies. As you might suspect, pietho is almost exclusively Pauline. It is used in Paul's letters and attributed to him throughout Acts. One of the few times it is found in association with Yahusha, Matanyah is translated using it to convey the religious mindset of the opposition by writing, but the chief priests and elders, pietho, the multitude, that they could ask for barbarosses and destroy Yahusha. So, folks, when you consider what Paul had to say, not only is the writing quality horrendous, but even when you fix the writing quality, the choices that Paul gives are pathetic. They're either he is, thinks he is, smarter than God, or he thinks that he is the smartest human in history and is that God chose him to persuade men. That, you know, God's testimony wasn't good enough. We have to reject all of that. His testimony, no, we can't rely on rules written for a different century. Well, we need Paul to fix it all up for us, come up with a new paradigm. And that Paul was the smartest man in human history, therefore he was the guy given that job. You know, and when you consider how else it's used, being so... In Matanyah, it's translated having the chief priests, the religious leaders, are the ones that are seducing the multitude, pietho the multitude. And that's not good for Paul. That makes Paul's use of the term the same as Yosha's depiction of the chief priests. You know, shortly thereafter in Matanyah 28:14, and now in a political setting, moving from a religious setting, Matanyah is translating using pietho again to say, and if this comes to the governor's ears, we will pietho him. We will convince him. We will persuade him. We will mislead him. Luke, who was Paul's attaché for a while, in his hearsay account, translates Yahusha using pietho twice, but neither translation is credible in that Luke wasn't an eyewitness, and Yahusha never spoke Greek. Now, I understand that religious individuals don't see any issue with men persuading other men on behalf of their God, but that's because they have been deceived into believing that it is God's will that we win souls for him. They see a conversion to their religion as a favorable event, as something that bolsters their faith. They not only send out evangelists to persuade people into believing as they do, the church has used the threat of violence to convert the masses for centuries. But not only is Paul's message opposed to God's message, winning souls isn't God's style. It isn't his goal. He's only interested in people who are interested in him. And all he wants of any of us to understand is who he is and what he's offering. That way we can choose.
That's our job, is just to share his words.
Correct.
We're not there to convince them. We don't have anything to lose.
Correct.
If they don't jump on board, if they don't take Yahweh's words seriously, which, by the way, most people won't.
Right.
You could lay Yahweh's words down in front of 1,000 people, and you would be lucky if one said, wow.
Yeah.
And stepped
that's
up
one
the
of the place. Reasons back for a long time. I have not heard this for a long time, but there was a period of time where I was receiving letters that said, you know, you got to get rid of that Larry guy. He's Mr. Meany. You know, he's, just bad guy, way too mean. And
I thought those were personal emails between me and you, Craig.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Actually, Larry and Scott are good friends. The reason that I never even thought about that for a moment is that your approach happens to be Yahweh's approach. It's Yahweh's approach. If somebody comes to you, not needing, because you're never going out to other people. You're never going into their religious setting and kicking the hornet's nest. If somebody comes to you, which in 100% of the cases, they came to you and they spew such religious rhetoric, it is our responsibility, if they come to us, to cite Yahweh's words in opposition to the point that they're making. And if we cite Yahweh's testimony, and we cite it accurately and consistently and thoroughly, and the person continues to advocate a religious objection, then it's perfectly appropriate for us to say, to hell with you. Go away.
Do you know what the biggest response I get is after sharing Yahweh's words, by the way?
Yeah.
You're hateful. So they're calling Yahweh's words hateful, and right. More than that, what they're wanting to show love is compromise.
Yeah. And Yahweh is not a compromiser. He is steadfast. He came up with a plan. He is who he is. He's offering one and only covering. It comes with 5 terms and conditions and 5 benefits. If you want to participate in it, you accept his conditions. He's not going to compromise with you or with anyone.